Hey, you guys, happy Sunday. Here we are again.
Yeah. DJ Maniac
and Ilsa.
And Ilsa. They met Starry Night last night. They sent me some photos. Let me see if I can put a picture up. Starry Night did a show in New York last night. They were telling me about that. What they were excited about doing that show when we saw them just a couple days back, a couple weeks ago, we saw them.
That was beginning of October. Absolution.
Yeah, there's DJ Maniac, Ilsa, and Michael from A Starry Night. Yeah.
Ilsa said it was so great. I got home at 7 a.m. Yeah. Holy shit. That was a good night. Yeah, she said, I think we met them all. I got a shirt. Yeah.
Yeah, Howard's the guitar player. He writes all the music. He's a fucking genius. I want a classic late 80s style song. You know, it's going to be, and he'll fucking just, the riffs, the sound, the, you know, he knows all the sounds that how something should sound. He does it. He knows all shit backwards and forwards. He's real good.
He's real into horror movies,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, real into horror movies.
Like real, kind of obscure horror movies. That's what I always end up talking to him about.
Yeah. But you can name a pretty obscure band from our times when we were a kid, and he knows all the songs on the album and everything.
Yep. He's one of those kind of guys. One of those kind of guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all really nice, to say. I mean, they're also an awesome band, but they're all just like really, they're really nice guys.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and give a shout out to A Starry Night, and it's called A-S-T-A-R-I-N-I-T-E. All their stuff's here on YouTube. And really good albums. It's the kind of band you just listen to a whole damn album in your car or a CD in your car. And they're kind of addictive. Each one of them, each album got better and better as they went.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all good, but yeah.
They're all good, but they got better as they went.
Yeah,
Ilsa sometimes said, it's the other way around. They get worse as they go. Starry got better as it went.
Yeah, Ilsa said, yeah, they were so nice. Yeah, they're really, really good.
Yeah.
They're really nice guys, too.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's talk about this movie. Now, this is interesting because how we got on this whole kick, and it's definitely a kick because we're doing two more, like tomorrow and the day after, of these kind of similar 70s thrillers type thing. We were doing, I guess when we were doing the review of The Believers, right, from 1987, and I mentioned that it had been directed by John Schlesinger, who had also done Marathon Man. And then you were kind of like, oh, yeah, Marathon Man, we need to totally see that. And then Rob Levinson, friend of the show, sent us a DVD or Blu-ray of it.
DVD.
A DVD of it.
Yeah.
And so we said we would do a matinee, which I think we talked about it a little bit on the Sidetrack show, but I said, well, we'll kind of save it so we can kind of just concentrate more on that. You know what I mean?
A lot of these old 70s flicks, if it's not totally remastered and redone for Blu-ray, it doesn't matter. Usually the DVD is about as good a quality as you want. If the quality gets any better, or the resolution gets any higher, the movie starts to suffer, actually, because they weren't filmed for a real high resolution.
Yeah. And this isn't really the kind of movie.
Not that kind of movie, yeah.
Yeah, this is like a thriller
kind
of thing. So it's not like a thing where it has these big sweeping vistas of landscapes and shit like that. It's that kind of, not that kind of thing.
It's a great movie. It holds up.
It really does. I hadn't seen it for ages. And honestly, and I think this is true of most people that probably haven't seen it for a long time. Pretty much the only scene, like, most people remember is the dentist torture scene.
Yeah.
The is it safe scene.
Yeah, is it safe?
And that even, like, keeps coming up. That comes up on, like, scariest movie scenes and all this other kind of stuff. And I had kind of forgot, I kind of remembered, like, what this movie was about. It's probably been 25 years at least since I've seen it. But I had forgotten, like, a lot of the little nuances, and I'd also forgotten how fucking star-studded this fucking shit
was. Yeah, all-star cast.
Man, everybody's done this bitch.
Yeah, I forgot that the brother, who was played by Roy Scheider, yeah, I forgot that he was kind of like the main character for half the damn movie. He was kind of like...
He's a major character.
Yeah, he doesn't work for the CIA, he works for a company that the CIA uses, and other FBI uses them too. They're contractors. They just called it, what did they call it? The company, right? And they called the company, working for the company.
Or they just, they just had kind of like a generic name for it.
And The edit is a little strange, especially the first 20 minutes. It's hard to kind of follow exactly what had happened. Some kind of secret mission happened, and I don't think I totally understand exactly what happened. The dude who got blown up with the box of chocolates in the antique shop. I don't really know how that was related. It was related to what's the main bad guy's name again? The Nazi guy.
What was Zell.
His? Zell. Yeah, it was Christian related to Zell. Christian Zell was his name. It was related to Zell in
Sir
some
Lawrence
way.
Olivier.
Yeah, which is they thought this was going to be his last movie because he was like on his deathbed, but he did so good in this movie. He lived for. He said, "Fuck it. I'm going to live another 13 years.
Yeah, because I was like, he was in Clash of the Titans like several years after this. Yeah. Like in 1981, he played Zeus, and we looked all right in that one.
We watched the extras at the end of it, you know, and Dustin Hoffman was talking about it. He said that he was... Dustin fucking kind of, you know, based on what he said, he believes what I believe, that your mentality has a lot to do with your health. And evidently, he was, his health was getting bad. He had cancer and all kinds of other stuff. And because he was down in the dumps, he was dying. But because of the success of this movie, it reinvigorated him. He lived for another 13 years.
Yeah, because, I mean, Laurence Olivier was their first choice. Yeah. That's who they wanted.
Everybody was the first choice.
And they were talking about, like, the producers and stuff were like, that never happens. I mean, obviously. But this is like, everybody that was the first choice, we got everybody we wanted.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening with Laurence Olivier, they wanted him, and he said he would do it, but then he got really sick. And then they were afraid that he wouldn't be able to do it. So I think for a little while, they thought they had Richard Widmark come in, and he was going to do it. But then... Laurence Olivier got better, and so they actually were able to get him. And like you said, they thought he was on his deathbed, but then he ended up living, what, another 13 years
13
or something?
13 years.
And he was in a bunch of other movies like after that, too.
And he had a lot of problems. Cancer, all kinds of problems with his joints, and I think they said varicose veins, real bad varicose veins.
Or gout.
Gout. That's what it was.
Yeah,
gout.
I think he had
couldn't
gout.
Barely walk, but he really pulled it out playing Zell in this, who's just a great character. They made sure to, you know, they were... Talking, you know, when they were discussing how they were going to do this, they didn't want Zell to be a stereotypical cartoon type villain, you know, just with the Nazi branding on him, you know what I mean? He was actually a complicated character. He wasn't really a Nazi because he had betrayed a bunch of Nazis. He was in the rat line. He was an ex-Nazi, but he didn't believe in any of that. It was just all about power and money.
Well,
he just
wanted the diamonds.
Diamonds, right.
I mean, this whole thing, like I said, the whole thing revolves around a cache of diamonds that was stolen from the Jews during the Holocaust.
Right.
That that actually Christian Zell and I guess his brother, who gets killed near the beginning, like in that road rage type situation.
Yeah, that's right.
That's kind of like the impetus for Zell coming to the U.S. because he had been hiding out in South America.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how... The one thing, though, okay, so, like, this, the plot is really complicated. What you were saying about the edit at the beginning, yeah, you do really kind of have to pay attention because it jumps back and forth in location without telling you.
Yeah.
That it's going, it's like, obviously, like, a lot of it's in New York. You have this scene where the brother of Christian Zell gets in this road rage type of thing with this other guy.
Yeah.
This other old guy.
Yeah. Which it was actually a pretty good scene that... Just kind of showed, I guess you could say, just like the ethnic warfare between these two factions that were fighting back in the honky motherland, and they're continuing to fight here in New York, and they kill each other. That was a fucking quite a twist. They both die in that. One guy was calling him a Nazi, the other guy was calling him a Jew, and they fucking boom, they kill each other, and that's kind of what.
Yeah, they ran into a fuel truck.
Yeah, they ran into a fuel truck. Yeah, and that's what called Zell into the United States.
Yeah,
but Dustin Hoffman, his character's brother, who was working for the company, he said that we don't know what the problem with Zell was. Remember that? He says he was not a threat. They said he had been giving up other Nazis for decades. He was worked for them off and on. Remember?
Yeah, well, because Doc, which is Roy Scheider's character's name, who's Dustin Hoffman's brother in the movie, like his older brother, there's this whole thing where Doc and that other guy, Janie or Janeway, whatever they call him, that's Bill Devane, plays him. And they are essentially couriers. They're trading favors because Zell gives them the names of other like war criminals, like Nazi escaped Nazis and stuff.
Yeah.
In exchange for having the diamonds like brought to him when he wants them.
So And remember, he's basically they let you know that, like I said, he's not a cartoon Nazi villain. He didn't give a shit about Nazis. He was turning them in too. And evidently it was like that back when the Nazis were around during the war. It was just a means of getting money and power.
Well, yeah, he was just very mercenary.
He was all
just,
by himself.
Yeah,
right.
He was just very mercenary.
And the CIA contractors went to him. They used him a lot. And he had special skills. And he didn't consider himself to be a bad guy in the way that you would. He considered himself to be this just artistic genius who is a dentist and good taste. And they make sure that you know that he thinks that about himself in the movie. Fucking Dustin Hoffman was talking about it in the extras. That, you know, he's torturing you, but he thinks it's great. This is just part of his job.
Well, Dustin Hoffman in the extras, he relates this thing. He's like, before, like, they were going to shoot the very famous torture scene where he's in there drilling into his teeth trying to get information out of Dustin Hoffman's character. And I guess they had been, like, thinking about it for a while, and Laurence Olivier wasn't sure how he was going to play it. And the story goes that Laurence Olivier saw, like, outside the hotel or wherever he was staying or whatever, and he saw this guy, like, a gardener, and he was, like, trimming roses. And he said this guy was just, you could tell that he was just so careful and, like, so meticulous.
Yeah.
And he was just, like, so into his job and, like, into these roses and everything. And he's, like, and he kind of had this revelation that he's, like, that's how I'm going to play that scene where it's almost kind of like he's taking a lot of pride in his work, like, torturing this poor guy.
Well, I like that touch because in real good stories, the villain never sees himself as a villain, really.
Well, that's kind of true of most villains, at least good ones, like in fiction.
Yeah, and that's just the way the world is. Everybody can see themselves as the good guy.
Yeah, I mean, well, like I said, and Dave Conte says, the fact that he was recognized near the end of the movie by a Holocaust survivor, actually two of them, tells you that he wasn't just some mercenary guy. He was later.
Yeah.
He did actually work in the camps, you know, and he was infamous at the camps as being a torturer because they had a name for him.
Yeah.
The White Angel.
Yeah, the White Angel.
So he's kind of based on Joseph Mengele.
Joseph Mengele.
That's what I was saying.
The same thing, they found Mengele's body, I think, during the time that my mother was stationed in Brazil. And that dude was another one that was just a mercenary. Mengele didn't give a shit about any of that. He wasn't a real Nazi, per se. He was in there to make money because people forget that they were in there doing medical research, and they were doing it for fucking big drug companies, some of them ties to America. And they were just making a lot of money on stuff. And when they found Mengele's body, they did an investigation. He was basically married to a black woman. A lot of those guys were not true believers in any of that. It was like they just saw opportunities and took them.
Well, and they were just, and they didn't give a shit.
No.
I mean, if they had to torture people or
kill
them.
No, just kind of cold-blooded.
They didn't give a shit about those people.
Yeah, it was like that damn experiment where they're getting people to shock other people. If you've got a government above you telling you that, hey, it's okay to kill these people, we say it's okay, then they're, well, okay. There's a lot of people that go along with it. Oh, okay, how much you gonna pay me? All right, fine. And there's a lot of psychopaths like that. A lot of normal people will do it. That Milgram experiment, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
The Milgram experiment? Yeah, they were... Dude in a lab coat was just telling some dudes to shock somebody else. They couldn't see him. And they'd go along with it because it was an authority figure telling them to do it.
I don't think it was the majority. I think about half people did. Well, half didn't get, like, went partially, and then they were like, nah, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah, anybody having to do with those camps, not only in Germany, but the camps in Japan, too, that they were doing, actually the Japanese camps in China, they were fucking psychos. They were psychos. Only a psycho could do that. They were kind of selected for that.
Yeah.
You know, a normal person couldn't do that. That's not who they were looking for. Yeah. They did psychological evaluations on guys, and they were looking right for the high-functioning psychopaths who had the skills, and they were sent there to do those jobs. Woo! Yeah. Imagine that.
But yeah, so what I was saying earlier about, like, the first part of the movie, so, you know, it starts in New York with that whole, like, thing, which is kind of, like, not, I want to say that that's not, it's not, like, really important to the plot. It's the thing that sets the plot into motion, you know what I mean? The two cars, like, hitting the you know, hitting the truck or whatever. Yeah. That sets the plot into motion. Right. But, you know, so it jumps, like, from New York, and they kind of, like, follow Dustin Hoffman's character, whose name is Babe Levy. And they kind of go a little bit into his backstory, like, about he's a PhD student. He's studying history, and he's studying, like, tyranny, like, throughout history. And they kind of go into the backstory about, like, his dad, who I guess was investigated during the McCarthy era and ended up shooting himself. So there's that whole thing. And then he kind of, like, talks a little bit about his brother, who... And then it jumps over to Paris, but it's not telling you that it's Paris yet. It's just kind of, like, jumping over there. And that's where Doc, Roy Scheider's character, is.
Yeah.
And there's, like, some sketchy shit. Like I said, you really kind of have to be paying attention because... And I probably should have put the closed captioning on, because a lot of the times, because I'm deaf as shit and I can't hear, like, a lot of dialogue. And if I can't hear the dialogue, then I don't have any, like, idea what's going on. But... After I watched it, I went back because I figured it out later, but then I went back and, like, read through the plot, and I was just kind of like, oh, okay, now it makes sense.
They didn't say much in the beginning.
Yeah, they don't really say much. And like I said, it kind of jumps from location to location, and you're not entirely sure. Like, you have to kind of be patient with it because you're like, well, how are all these threads? How do all these threads, like, tie together? But then, like I said, you have to kind of, like, just wait, because it does all come together in the end. It's just that at first it seems like it's kind of, like, jumping around, and you're like, okay, well, I don't know how this has to do with that. One thing that's still confusing, and if you guys have seen this movie, please tell me. So at the beginning part, before Doc comes to New York, like, when he's still in Paris, and he goes to the antique shop, right? And he talks to that guy, like, the owner of the antique shop, and they talk about something or other. Now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but before he goes to visit that guy, Roy Scheider goes to, like, a chocolate shop, and he buys, like, a box of chocolates. And then he goes back to his hotel room and dumps those chocolates out and puts in another one that looks like the same thing. And then he takes them to that guy, and I say, did he just poison that guy? But then, like, something blows up, but then, like, later on, he's supposed to meet that guy at the theater, and when he gets to the theater, the guy's there, but his throat is cut. So I'm like, wait a minute, well, then what, like, because I thought that he was, like, who did he kill then?
Right.
I didn't, I looked on the Wikipedia thing, and I was just kind of like...
It was vague there, too.
Yeah, it was kind of, and, well, it didn't even mention it, and so I was just kind of like, well, why the switching chocolates? Because I kind of, I mean, the first thing I thought, oh, he's going to poison that dude. But that wasn't what it was. But then, like, something blew up. But then, was the bomb intended for Doc? Because he kind of came out of the car and he was like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Like, so he didn't know that it was. And then, but like I said, I thought, oh, he blew up the French guy. But then later he goes to meet him at the opera house.
Maybe the
dude was up in the box and his throat was cut, like somebody else had got to him first.
Maybe the chocolates were explosive and they blew up, but it didn't kill him. It was maybe he intended to kill him, but it didn't. I don't know. I didn't really.
Yeah, but then if he had intended to kill him, then why would he go to the theater later to meet him?
No.
See, that didn't make any sense to me. I didn't really understand. But see,
something's missing.
Yeah, what was going on was that Doc, as well as Janie, that other guy, and presumably the French guy, those were all couriers for Zell.
Yeah.
So what they would do was they would go back and forth, and like they would go and get his cache of diamonds and like bring it to him in exchange for information about other war criminals. So what ended up happening was that after Zell's brother died in New York, he decided, well, I'm not going to fuck with all these couriers anymore, because I guess even though his brother dying was like an accident, essentially, or it didn't have anything to do with what's going on. But I guess he thought, oh, well, somebody killed my brother, so they're turning on me, so I'm going to wipe out all of my couriers. So that's why, like, somebody came in Doc's room and, like, tried to kill him. That's why that guy, like, with the white eyes was trying to kill Doc in Paris and stuff like that, because Zell was trying to wipe out all of the couriers, like, because he thought that they were targeting him because his brother died. I don't think he got that, like, his brother's death didn't have anything to do with the plot. You know what I mean? Or what was going on. But I'm still, like, confused about that thing in France. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, Dave, I read your comment. Now, just because if you go back in history and look at the actual players that did that, a lot of that shit, they weren't true believers. They just did it because there was money and they were told them to do it. But then, like, this is accurate. Then they'd go on the run in the rat line, and they'd turn out, they would, you know, talk shit about the Third Reich and fucking turn dudes in, and Oh, they were like, yeah, it was all bullshit. I just wanted the money and the power or whatever. And they didn't believe in any of that. They just did it because they were criminals. Just a lot of it was that. And you could get them to roll on each other a lot, which that's what Zell was doing. Because they didn't care. They only cared about themselves. They were psychos.
Yeah, and another thing, too, is that, interestingly, Dustin Hoffman's character, he actually initially had nothing to do with all of this plot that was going on and had no idea what any of this stuff was, because he thought Doc's cover story, his brother's cover story, was that he worked as an oil company executive. And that is what, that's what Dustin Hoffman thought, that his brother did that. But then when the brother came there and, you know, the brother ends up getting killed, and then for whatever reason, like, Zell thinks that the brother knows some information, even though he doesn't and doesn't have anything to do with it. That's when he starts torturing him, like, to try to get information. And that's kind of when all the other guys, like, you know, the guys that had been doing stuff for Zell or working with Zell, like, for through the CIA or contract or whatever they were doing, that's when they started. Because Janie, that one guy, the guy that Bill Devane plays, he's kind of like a double agent. He's kind of like working both sides. You know what I mean? Because yeah. He initially, like, tried to help Dustin Hoffman, like, you know, trying to get him away from Zell, but then he's like, no, never mind, and he, like, takes him back, because they thought that he knew something, like, some kind of valuable information.
Yeah. The good thing, another thing I liked about it is it's, in some ways, the movie is kind of, like, along the same vein as 3 Days of the Condor. It just shows all these guys that are in this, what they call, intelligence community, which they kind of scoff at that in 3 Days of the Condor, that fucking, they betray each other all the time.
Pat Atfield asked, I'd also like to know if this is based on a book. Yes, it is. It's based on the book by William Goldman, who has written shit tons of books and screenplays and shit like that. He's got a couple Oscars. He wrote All the President's Men. He wrote The Princess Bride. He wrote tons and tons of different stuff. Actually, like, before this book was even published, the producers bought the rights to it for, like, $500,000. Because they said it's very, very rare. Like, even the guy that bought the rights was like, this is the best shit I've read since The Godfather. He's like, this almost reads like a movie already. And he's like, and we can't lose if we don't fuck it up. So it was so, so the book rights were bought before the book even was published. Now, William Goldman also wrote the screenplay. However, they changed the ending from the book. There's a couple different things in the book. In the book, one thing that's in the book that I think they only very, very briefly kind of imply in the movie is that Doc and Janeway, are gay lovers, okay? That's in the book. That's not really in the movie. I think there's one, like, kind of throwaway line that you could kind of read like that, but they took that out of the movie. The ending is also different. In the ending of the book, it kind of ends the same where, you know, they give Babe, Dustin Hoffman's character, they give him the information where Zell is, because Babe says, I'm going to go kill the motherfucker. And in the book, he actually just does go and just, like, kills the dude in cold blood, right? In the movie, Dustin Hoffman didn't really want to do that. Like, he didn't want it to end that way. And he kind of explained, like, why he didn't want, like, on the extras, they interviewed him extensively about it. And I think what he was getting at was that he didn't want his character to be seen as, like, the same as that guy. Like, he wanted to see, like, be the better man or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he does end up, like, you know, the Nazi does end up dying, but he doesn't end up, like, straight up killing him. Although he does plan to. He's going to.
Yeah, Zell actually kills himself by accident.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah, and William Goldman famously really did not like that ending. He called it shit. Quote unquote. But I don't know. I can see either way. Like, I can understand why Dustin Hoffman just thought
he didn't want moral equivalency.
Yeah, he didn't want. Yeah. He's like, you know, my character, I want him to be, even though he does say in the movie that I want to kill that motherfucker, and he takes the information and everything, and he does intend to, but then when he's right in front of his face, he can't really bring himself to do it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I guess that's why, because he's just like, well, I don't want to be the same as that guy.
Yeah.
So I get that. I get why he didn't want to do that. Yeah, but,
killing a cold-blooded killer in cold blood makes you a cold-blooded killer.
Yeah, so I can totally
that's
see
what he's talking about.
I mean, even though like from a point of view of like the book, you'd be like, yeah kill that fucker. But you know what I mean? But I can see how in the movie it would have. It makes it less complicated, and it makes him like a less sympathetic character, I guess.
Yeah.
Even though I don't know.
Well, I think Dustin Hoffman wanted the character to be kind of like an example of better morality for audience. Did not moral equivalency. But like I said, the author of the book says, "Yeah, it's a shit," because that's more like the way the world really is.
Yeah, but like I said, you know, movies and real life aren't really the same thing,
right?
But I can see. There's arguments for both sides. I don't really have a problem with either ending, so I'm not really bothered. Now, interestingly, and here's something that was also on the Wikipedia page, and I think this is kind of like a famous story about the making of this movie, which I'm not sure is entirely. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying that it's kind of like misperceived a little bit. I think that there was there's kind of a perception that Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier didn't get along when they were making this movie, mainly because Laurence Olivier was very old school Hollywood, very theatrical. You know, he had a Shakespearean background, yada yada, obviously. And Dustin Hoffman, even though he was almost 40 when this movie was made, which blew our minds. I was just sitting there because he's playing a grad student in the movie. And he said when he was asked to do the movie that he even thought it was weird. He's like, aren't I a little old for this role? But it worked because he doesn't come across as somebody that's 40 years old. You know what I mean? So I was actually surprised when he said, yeah, I was almost 40 when we made this movie and I thought I was too old for it. But it worked out because he doesn't come across like that. But he was kind of like more, even though he was almost 40, he was almost like a younger Hollywood type thing. So he's kind of like a very instinctual kind of actor and has like a little bit of a method acting kind of thing where, and there's a very famous story about this, very famous anecdote about this movie where they're like, you know, in one part of the movie, he had to have been, like, his character had to have been, like, awake for 3 days or, like, hadn't eaten and stuff. So Dustin Hoffman's like, so I just stayed up for 3 days and didn't eat, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then Laurence Olivier very famously said to him, it's like, why don't you try acting? But, like, instead of actually doing it. But actually, Dustin Hoffman, he talked about that a great deal. And he was like, I wanted to clarify. He's like, he did say that, but they're like, you're kind of missing like all of the context of, he's like, he didn't mean it like, you know, oh, you lame ass, like you can't even act, like you have to do it for real. It's like, he didn't mean it like that. Like he kind of clarified what he meant after that. And honestly, like all the behind the scenes stuff, they looked like they got along really well. And Dustin Hoffman said after the movie wrapped, Laurence Olivier came to his house and brought him this big box of all of his, you know, the Shakespeare plays and, like, the books and stuff that he'd been in, that he had all his acting notes, like, wrote in there, and he gave them, like, to Dustin Hoffman as a present. And even this many years later, like, Dustin Hoffman's kind of tearing up, like, talking about it. He's like, and he said, made a joke about how I think I want to be buried with these, because it's, like, one of the most awesome things I ever got. So it did really kind of seem like they got a little, yes, their styles were very different, but I think that it's kind of been overblown, like how they didn't get along on set and shit like that.
Hoffman was really one of the best actors in Hollywood, in modern Hollywood. He was good. He could pull off some crazy ass roles. And he wasn't a man for any old role, but if you had a crazy ass role, like Tootsie or Rain Man, he would go all out to try to bring that role to the big screen. Now, as his career went on, you know, the movies started to suffer. That really wasn't him. It was just casting, I think. I mean, he was doing something about pandemics that weren't all that great. And
What was that one called? I can't remember what that one was called. I know what you're talking about.
They just stopped offering him choice shit. He was starting to age out. He was much older than you thought he was when you looked at him.
Yeah, because like I said, I was like, really? He was almost 40 in 1976? Holy crap.
Yeah.
I didn't realize. I guess I just thought.
So he just kind of, he wasn't getting choice roles, so he just retired, which is that's what you do.
Well, he had Outbreak, that was the, Outbreak.
Yeah, Outbreak.
I remember that being okay. I remember that being okay.
Anybody could have done that role, though.
That's true.
You didn't need Dustin Hoffman for that. That was just paycheck.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't, you know, I don't shit on actors. Like, once they get older, like, shit gets tough out there, man. It's like, everybody wants, like, the newest, hottest thing. It's like, once you get into your 40s and 50s, everybody's like, yeah, they're just, you know, you're going to end up on, like, fucking Lifetime Christmas movies and shit like that if you're not careful. So, you know, unless you're, you know, and I'm not saying there are, like, obviously some older actors that, you know, still get a lot of, like, really prestigious work and everything like that. But in general...
I remember one time where he said he wanted to play James Bond. Imagine that.
Really?
Yeah, a long time
ago.
I think it was him that said that.
I don't know if that. I don't know if that would work.
Yeah, he wanted to be James Bond, but
he's not British, though.
No, he could fake it.
He could. Yeah, maybe he could fake it.
That's what he was.
But, although, honestly, I can't really think of any. I'm sure someone will think of something, but I can't really think of an American actor that has very convincingly played a British person. The accent is never exactly right.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of British actors that can play Americans that I didn't realize that they were not Americans.
Yeah.
But
like
I've...
The Walking Dead.
Yeah, I've never seen the reverse, though.
Yeah. Over time, I was able to go, yeah, he is a little... He is kind of hamming it up a little bit with the word with Carl. The word, you know, he's...
Well, right. The thing, though, is
it,
that...
It did sound...
If you didn't know that he was British...
Yeah.
Which we didn't when I was... Because I hadn't seen Love Actually at that point, because he was also in Love Actually, like, before that, which is, like, a British movie. So I didn't realize that Andrew Lincoln was British.
Yeah.
So I didn't question it. You know what I mean? It didn't sound weird to me or anything like that. But like I said, it's really hard...
That was supposed to be Mississippi, Alabama around that time. And if you listen... The difference between him and say who's the other guy? Guy who's really from Mississippi. Shit. Guy who played Merle.
Michael Rooker.
Michael Rooker, yeah. You can it reminds me of how different it actually is. Michael Rooker actually has the real accent.
Well, yeah, because he's actually from
He's actually from Mississippi.
That's but like I said, I mean, the one Andrew Lincoln did was passable.
It almost sounded something like Virginia, though.
And it's honestly, if you just went up to him and he was talking like that, I wouldn't question it. I wouldn't be like, are you a British person masquerading?
Yeah,
that would never occur to me.
It's just that it wasn't quite Alabama, Mississippi, more like Virginia. It's a little bit different. Maybe Texas. Something like that.
Roy says there was a lot of films to do with whatever happened to the Nazis after the war type of films. Yeah, there were, like, particularly around that era.
Well, it was just ripe for books and spy novels. It was a great, you know what I mean? They didn't get them all. A lot of them fucking.
Yeah, so that's ripe for fiction.
Right.
And nonfiction, too. Love Dustin Hoffman and The Graduate. We need to get around to doing that one of these days because I really like that movie.
We watched Midnight Cowboy last night. It's a great movie.
We'll probably do that one Tuesday because we watched another one like that we weren't going to do in between.
The more I thought about it, the more I realized how deep that movie was. The movie was very deep. A lot of symbolism in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then...
Sexual psychology and shit.
Yeah. We're also bringing up Straw Dogs, which was also a fantastic movie, which is another one that we haven't done. God, there's so many that we haven't. Yeah, Grampther's Hammer was talking about Dustin Hoffman, ended up in the Meet the Fockers franchise. You know what? I have not seen a single one of those, and I just feel like I probably never will. And I'm happy with my decision. Sheila Ann says he was self-conscious of his looks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess.
I forgot about Boys from Brazil. That was another good movie. Yeah,
we need to see that one again, too. Grampther's Hammer said Renee Zellweger played Bridget Jones. I saw that, but I still... I think her accent wasn't that good. It wasn't the worst, but she did not sound like a British person to me. It was okay, but I still knew that that was not what she really talked like. Camp Guy said British folks are much better at doing accents. Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's not what it is. What it is that British actors actually come from the theater, from a very good training programs. American actors don't. American actors typically came from the Hollywood scene, which was mostly happening in nightclubs and cocaine-fueled fucking orgies. Like, and you got the part, where, you know, depending on fucking who you put out to and fucking how much coke you're willing to invest, shit like that. Hollywood was corrupt. It was a party scene. They didn't take it seriously. It was just movies. You know?
Yeah.
Hoffman was a fucking... Actually, he could act. There were a lot of them in the 70s that could act, but they... A lot of them didn't really survive the 80s too well. They slowly started to drop off. And,
Well,
Hollywood is fucking cheap.
Well, and the thing about the late 60s and early 70s was kind of like an auteur decade where people were kind of willing to watch these sort of boundary crossing movies, you know, more art films, stuff like that. So I kind of feel like there was more opportunity if you were a really good actor to get into something like really critically acclaimed and stuff like that. Whereas when the 80s came along, everything was just kind of like cheap schlock or big like blockbusters.
Yeah.
So if you weren't, if you were just kind of like this actor, then, you know, there was still like a lot of indie movies in the 80s, obviously, but it wasn't as, I don't know. I just feel like in the 70s was kind of like the heyday of
A lot of the best American movies, especially sci-fi and action type movies from the late 70s and into the 80s, they're movies that on a surface you say, yeah, it's an American movie. But if you look at the details, man, they were British. Like Alien 2 was a British movie. Aliens might have been British. That might have been done at those studios there.
What, the first Alien?
The first one.
Oh, I can't remember.
I don't think that was American. A lot of that stuff was not technically not American. You had to go to England to get a lot of that shit done because those studios had real professional casts that fucking worked well and knew how things should look. You'd end up with something that was kind of aged and worn and would look realistic, you know, like the Star Wars used universe. You know, that's the British did that shit. Hate to say it.
Well, probably the Americans wouldn't even have thought of that.
No. No, American sci-fi, this shit look brand spanking new.
Everything is like shiny.
Damn cardboard. Yeah. Yeah, it just wasn't really well thought out. And it would have cost a lot more in the United States because of all the palms you'd have to grease and the corruption and the scheduling wouldn't have worked. And when they made, you know, when Lucas made the first Star Wars, he didn't really know what he was doing either, you know. Like, and it was going falling way behind schedule because they said it wasn't being run like a real, even though it was in one of those British studios, his directing style was just like something from some kid from school would do. There was just bad fucking scheduling and fucking bad discipline on the set. And Lucas was kind of a failure his first couple movies. I think Steven Spielberg whipped him into shape. I think Steven Spielberg is one
of the ones that actually
taught him how to fucking make a movie. In a timely fashion.
Yeah, quit fucking around, George.
Yeah. George was a great idea, man, though.
Oh, yeah.
Great idea.
But like I said, not everybody's good at everything.
Yeah.
You know, you can be, like, completely brilliant at one thing and, like, suck at everything else. It's like, you know, that's just the way the shit rolls.
My favorite movie of his, you know, was actually THX 1138. I think that was his best movie.
That's a pretty fantastic movie. So have we done that movie? We've done it, right?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we've done THX.
I thought we'd done it.
There's two of them. One of them he did for school, and the other one that got released to the big screen. I liked the one that was released for the big screen.
I thought we had it. We have it,
don't
we?
I don't have it.
Oh, shit.
It's been redone, and some, you know, he Lucasfied it, you know what I mean? It inserted some scenes and some CG and shit, and fucking, they CGI'd over the little dwarves, the little shell dwellers. They made them look non-human, because I guess they didn't want to insult midgets or something. I don't know what it fucking was. But that they should have left those because he got that from Brave New World. In the Brave New World series, all the little D-level workers and everything were dwarves. You know? It made them small on purpose. And small with low IQs. They were like human robots. And it's a dystopian future. That's like some shit that they would do.
Camp Guy says, I need to watch Midnight Cowboy and Dog Day Afternoon. Yeah, like I said, we watched Midnight Cowboy last night, so we're going to we're not going to do it tomorrow, we'll do it Tuesday.
Midnight Cowboy.
Because like I said, we have another movie we're going to do tomorrow that we also watched.
Midnight Cowboy is a much better movie than I remembered. Now that I'm older seeing it, I understood it a lot better.
This is why if a movie is like a classic and the first time you saw it, you were young or you just didn't get it or whatever, you should definitely give it another chance. Every decade of your life.
When you see when you're young, it's just some crazy flick about this dude, this cowboy from Texas who goes to New York to try to pimp himself out to old women, and he makes friends with this dude named Ratso, who's just exactly the opposite to him, a little ugly, fucking club-footed, fucking shell dweller living in a damn abandoned apartment, you know what I mean? He's just a totally untrustworthy con man. But there's a lot more to that movie. than that. It's it has to do with sexual psychology.
It's not a classic for nothing. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Right. And then as the story unfolds, they start doing flashbacks, and the flashbacks explain why this fucking dude from Texas just, why he's doing what he's doing. You know? It makes sense from his point of view if he had his background. But it ends up being resolved.
Save it for Tuesday.
Yeah, gotta save it for Tuesday. Yeah.
Badass Domain says, you guys should do Hook with Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams. You know what? I haven't seen that in a really long time.
I hated that movie when I saw it.
Really? I remember like thinking, ah, that was all right. But I don't, you know, like I said, it's been such a long time. I don't remember hardly anything about it.
What I remember liking better was Robin Williams' Popeye. The live-action Popeye.
I kind of liked that, too.
I remember liking it.
It's probably terrible. I don't know.
Crazy. I remember it just being crazy. But I remember liking it.
It's like, I love Robin Williams, but I tend to like his later movies when he was kind of more like in a series, because he could fucking act, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, he was genius.
But it's just, you know, a lot of times, like, I think that, you know, as funny as his shit was, like, in the 80s, I don't know. Like, nowadays, I think I'm too old because I'm just like, oh, dude, he's, like, so coked out. Can you just, like, kind of, like, bring it down a couple notches? But you know. But the shit was cool back then, though.
Robin Williams' best movie was fucking 1 Hour Photo. And that's almost like a goddamn horror movie. That was his best
movie. Need to see Insomnia.
Yeah.
He played kind of, like, a similar role in that as well. Like, kind of a scary. Was he a serial killer? I kind of feel like he was a serial killer in that. Caroline Dyson says, we're talking about accents. David Morrissey's accent as the governor was awful on Walking Dead. Now that I'm thinking, because he's a Brit too. Yeah. So he couldn't really do an American one all that. Yeah, that was a little weird. He did. Yeah, he just sounded a little strange. Strawdog78 says, Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes' accent was decent. Yeah, I remember that being passable. Granthers Hammer says, worst accent in recent movie history, Jennifer Lawrence in Red Sparrow. She sounded like Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle. Oh my god, now I'm gonna have to see that. Donald Pleasance was in THX 1138. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And a lot of that shit in THX 1138 kind of came true over time. Everybody being on these SSRI inhibitors and whole cultures about buying useless things and worshiping commerce and how it's just fucking, that's a badass movie. I liked it. They're just people living in a fake society. A more dystopic version of Logan's Run.
Yeah.
It's just a totally drugged up society. You're to evade drugs was to commit a criminal offense, and you couldn't have sex either. That was it was called a sex crime, and they'd fucking lock you up for it. But even the average person could escape from that prison. That was just a weird. People had such dependent personalities. They stayed right where you put them. It was a weird, weird movie.
Louis points out American Graffiti is a great movie by Lucas, and that was early in his film career.
That was pretty good too. Yeah, that was good too. Kind of a slice of life movie.
I need to see that one again, too. Yeah, like, I've seen all of these movies, but it's, like, it's been so long since I've seen them.
It didn't make a big impression on me, though.
You know, but it might now. Like I said, it might be one of those things that, like, needs time to, like, gestate. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because I've seen some movies. Well, I have the opposite thing, too, where it's, like, movies I saw when I was younger, and I was like, man, this is the most awesome thing ever. But then, like, later I saw it, and I'm just like, what the fuck was I even thinking?
Yeah.
But yeah, then sometimes I see a movie like a long time ago and I was just like meh, but then I see it again and I'm like, oh my god, that was awesome. What the fuck?
Some of them aged really well. Like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I like that now than I liked it more now than I did when
I did too. The first time I saw it, I was just kinda like, eh.
Yeah, it's like okay.
I didn't really care about it. But then like when I saw it again recently, I was just kinda like, oh my god, it's like I totally missed like all of this shit that was going on in there.
There's a lot of good dialogue in it. Funny shit happened. He's throwing the trees into the fucking window of the house. And goes,
what did the kid say? I love that
shit. The kid said something. Can we throw that in there too? You know,
it was just funny shit. That was super funny.
What the kid said. Kid said something funny. Had me fucking rolling.
Yeah, I can't remember either. Yeah, Serpent Surfer. This made me laugh. The Carry On series had better set direction than most American productions at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think how many Carry On movies were there, because I've maybe seen one or two of them. This is like a very long-running British film series. It's always like Carry On something, like Carry On Walking or Carry On whatever the fuck. And it's like always has a word at the end. And they're just kind of like essentially farces. They're usually like sex comedy type funny shit like that, is from what I remember.
Hollywood got better as it went on because it had to. Back when they had a monopoly over all the theaters and basically, you know what I mean? They could basically get away with murder. Television came in and it started to, you know, hurt their profits. They had to get a little bit better. You had to do better than television, which that went on for a while. But now that a lot of these series are so good and you got Silicon Valley involved in making movies and funding fucking all these indie films that are great, you know what I mean? Great indie films that are happening. Hollywood's playing catch up, man. You can't fuck around like they did back in the day. It's got to be efficient. You can't waste money. And Hollywood just wastes money or lie about how much they spent, because there was a bunch of shenanigans going on, tax evasion shit and laundering money through movies, and sex trade was happening through movies and shit. Just look at the Weinstein thing, you know what I mean? If you have the power to give a woman a job and that job would make her $1 million or $2 million, these guys would go, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to give you this job. And you'll make $2 million, but you're going to have to blow me. Oh, and by the way, blow him. And that one. Blow that one over there. And that was kind of going on all the way back into the 20s during the silver screen era. It's kind of where actresses got the reputation for just being hookers, which they kind of were. And that kind of went on into the damn fashion industry. Celebrities and rich guys didn't go to the damn escort services. They went to those modeling agencies. Modeling agency was just an escort service for fucking rich dudes. Sad but true.
Badass Domain says, would you guys review Convoy, Smokey and the Bandit, and the Cannonball Run movies?
Yeah.
We might get around to that. Honestly, when I was a kid, I used to love Smokey and the Bandit and the Cannonball Run movies. Yeah. This is kind of related. The other night, I actually watched the Riff Tracks version of Breaker Breaker, the early Chuck Norris film. Wow, that movie is painfully bad.
Really bad, yeah.
But super fun with the Riff Tracks commentary there. What a stupid fucking movie.
I remember Cannonball 1 and 2. I remember them being as like star-studded.
Yeah, everybody was in that.
Everybody was in them. They were like laugh a minute is the way I remembered them, and they were just kind of like, they were kind of epic in a way, but they were also like really, really corny. And they were supposed to be corny. It wasn't supposed to represent. And then I remember Smokey and the Bandit being pretty corny too, but for some reason we liked it. I don't know why.
There was something. I guess there was something kind of charming about it.
Yeah.
You know. Well, that was like
Sally Fields was in it. She was cute as shit.
That's true.
That was one thing about it.
I mean, and that's like I said, I can't comment because I probably haven't seen it since the late 1980s.
Yeah.
That's probably like the last time I saw any of them, and I remember really liking those and thinking they were funny. But now I might watch it and just be like,
yeah. Humor doesn't age that well in general.
Like I said, it depends. Like, sometimes I'll see a movie like of comedy that came out back then that's still funny, but most of the time, not so much.
I tried to watch History of the World Part 1, and that shit, I just couldn't get through it. It just fucking sucked. I remember thinking it was hilarious when I was a kid. The only one that aged pretty well was Airplane.
Well, and Mel Brooks movies, Blazing Saddles, aged well, and Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, like, Young Frankenstein.
But I haven't seen, like, the other ones. Like, I used to really love Spaceballs, but I haven't seen that in a really long time.
I didn't like it when it came out. I didn't think it was funny.
So I don't know if I would not think it was funny nowadays. Yeah. I'm not really sure.
Corny shit. Although, I imagine Blazing Saddles is probably still pretty funny, because that's fucking Gene Wilder's in that shit.
I mean, how can you not love Gene Wilder? Come on.
Wilder.
Grampthers Hammer says Blues Brothers is still a hoot. Yeah. Man, I need to watch that one again too. I haven't seen that one probably since 1987 or like that.
Another one I want to see again is Stir Crazy.
Oh yeah,
Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder go to prison. I'm gonna see that one.
Yeah.
I remember thinking it was hilarious, but how bad could it be? It's got Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder in it. It's got to be good.
I mean, yeah, just watching the two of them, you know, just farting around is, like, funny. Yeah. So, like I said, the best thing, and I think I talked about this when we talked about Young Frankenstein, Gene Wilder is just kind of like, he's just one of those dudes that's just funny. It just seems like effortless. Like, even he's not telling a joke or nothing like that. It's just, like, funny.
It's his facial expressions.
I guess.
And he kind of had this fucking soft voice that he would say.
But you also had the impression that he might just, like, flip out at, like, any moment.
And he was constantly seemed to be on the verge of busting up and breaking character. And, you know, he's trying to keep it together. And it's making you laugh because you can see that he's getting ready to fucking lose it sometimes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Although I will say that in what do you call it? The Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah. That scene at the end, when I was a kid, that scene at the end where he yells at Charlie, wrong, sir, wrong, that used to, like, scare the shit out of me, because he'd been so nice, and, like, he's kind of a little bit sinister, but then, like, when he flips out at the end, I was like, like, when I was a little kid, I was like, he was so nice, now he's yelling at me, oh my God. Yeah. But yeah, so he was, like, fucking genius at those type of roles. Louis says, Cannonball Run, Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. is a priest. Yeah, that, I remember that being, like, really funny. I remember the two of them, and I remember, like, the two hot chicks and the shiny zippered, like, whatever you call, what do you call them?
Jumpsuits.
There you go.
If you look closely at Sammy Davis Jr., he's actually dressed as a satanic priest.
He is, yeah.
He's wearing a head of Baphomet.
And they don't, do they even bring it up in the
never
movie?
Bring it up.
Which is, like, that makes it funnier.
He's wearing a head of Baphomet necklace, and it's the necklace that Anton LaVey gave him.
Yeah.
I don't even know that, but Anton LaVey gave him a fucking necklace and made him like a bishop of the Satanic Church.
Which, how fucking rad is that? Yeah. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Which is an honorary title. It's just
he's like, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to go to the meeting.
Evidently they met. LaVey was impressed with his singing and dancing and just thought he was the greatest, so he just gave him a necklace and made him a fucking bishop, I think. Well, thank you very much. But he thought it was a fucking trip, so he wore it in Cannonball Run.
Grampthers Hammer said, I was Mike TV in a local production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when I was 12. Mary Lynn Rice Cub was an Oompa Loompa.
Really? Yeah.
Is that true? I hope it is.
That was before I knew her.
Was she like the head Oompa Loompa?
Mm-hmm.
Was there even a head Oompa Loompa? Not really. No. They were all kind of...
They were all about to say.
It was all democratized. Oh my goodness, Pokey. All right, are we done talking?
Yeah.
All right, so, yeah. So, again, thank you, Rob, for sending us Marathon Man. Like I said, the DVD is good. It's got, like, a behind-the-scenes thing from, like, the time period, sort of like the 70s, and then it has one from, I don't know how old the other interview that they have is, but it was after Laurence Olivier died, but they, you know, Dustin Hoffman looks... Still, he looks old, but, like, fairly young, so I don't know. Maybe it was from, like, the early 2000s or something like that. But, yeah, it's an awesome movie. Really good 70s thriller. If anybody's read the book, let me know if that's any good. Because, like I said, I've heard it was a lot different. I've read some of William Goldman's stuff, but not that one.
Oh, let me tell him. We also, because you guys might want to watch it before you see the show, we saw Capricorn 1.
Go we're going to talk about Capricorn 1 tomorrow.
It's free on Amazon Prime. And it's a good one. You got to check it out.
I had forgotten how good that movie was.
Good,
it's super fun.
A lot of fucking twists that threw me. It's not about faking a moon landing. It's about faking the Mars landing. But that's just the beginning.
Same kind. Yeah. But yeah, so we watched. So that's the one we're going to talk about tomorrow. And then we'll do Midnight Cowboy on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that we've been watching over this weekend. All right. So thanks, everybody, for dropping by. And we will see you guys again tomorrow.